up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the news, so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
One up, back Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom. I'm Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 8, NASDAQ Futures up 26. Trying to come back from a pretty steep sell-off yesterday. For those who weren't glued to the TV, NASDAQ was down 198, so that's 1.1%. S&P was down 33, so we're bouncing back, I'm going to say a third of it in the S&P, and not even close to that, maybe a sixth of it. The NASDAQ so far. NVIDIA, the big news of the week was NVIDIA's earnings. They kind of beat on revenue and stuff, but in terms of the growth pattern, slowing down maybe a little. So the stock's down 480 this morning, 120.85. So not a big move. The straddle was priced at, it was like 15 or something, Greg, or something along those lines. 15 or 16?
Yeah, it was 15.
So yeah, it's not nowhere near. For once, lately, the straddle sellers seem to have won, but they haven't won too much lately. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning. How are you?
So I'm good. How are you? What's a good word?
Let's see. The good word is that I'm not seeing the sun coming up anymore when we start the program here.
Yeah, I know. As of this week, I'm sneaking in the dark in the morning. I can't say as I like that so much, but not much you can do about it. It means trip around the sun, Lou, you and me.
I'd be nervous. I'd be nervous if it wasn't happening. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? But a lot of stuff going on. I hearken, you know, I don't really play in Andy and Mayberry, but I seem to recall that the actual campaigning for the election didn't start after Labor Day. Wasn't that like the gentle person's agreement? That's by the boards, eh?
Well, my recollection is that the never-ending campaign talk started with the second Clinton campaign, and that's where I first started hearing, discussion about every single thing being turned to, you know, to the next upcoming election. I wanted to reference something that I didn't reference last week, and it's become more noteworthy now. I used to teach at the Air Force Special Operations School down in Hurlburt Field in Florida, and I taught a block on dealing with Russians, and because the former Soviet Union had broken up, or the Soviet Union had broken up, and we were now dealing with a number of, you know, other nation states, and this was around the time of just after the Balkan War, and I remember there was a Russian candidate who was a far-right ultra-nationalist who was running against Yeltsin in one of their presidential elections. And I was noting for the class just how different things were in Russia than they were here. And I said, so for example, the press, which, you know, is unabashedly partisan in Russia, has turned against this ultra-nationalist, and he can't get press coverage for anything he wants. If he gives a speech and 200,000 people show up, you will not see a mention of it in the dailies, and they just are absolutely stifling this guy in support of another candidate. And I said, it's radically different than it is here. Well, you know, fast forward 30 years, and our press is like the Russian press. The suppression of stories. I mean, it's amazing to me how fast the Donald Trump assassination story disappeared.
Well, the guy's dead. How much you can talk about it?
Well, not only is he... Well, there's all kinds of things to talk about. How long would that story be flogged if that guy had taken a shot
Harris? Nobody knows.
Oh, yeah, it would be longer than it was. And so to watch the press suppress these stories, the Zuckerberg letter, which did barely even made a ripple in the headlines, you know, where he basically confesses that the federal government was censoring speech through his platform, and, you know, basically validates the allegations that were made, you know, early on or in 2020 about the election being rigged. Anyway, the point that I was making is I consider this to be a very dangerous time, and our press looks more like the press of Russia in 1993 and 1994 than it does, you know, the American press. And this goes right to the heart of this campaign issue. Again, if the Republicans were now talking to people and said, yeah, we're not going to talk to the press for 35 or 45 days, we're not going to give an interview, you know, all hell would be breaking loose. You know that. And it's not.
By the way, you know who you agree with. You're a very likable fellow, but you're not as attractive as this young lady is or was. I told you this story. One of the waitresses over at Ceres, young girl she was from Romania. And she sits down one night and she goes, Chief, can I talk to you? And I'm going, okay, I hope this isn't like something serious. And she goes, well, you know, I can't believe I'm in this country. I want to be here. This is 10 years ago, Lou. And she goes, when I was a little young girl growing up over there and it was communist run, the newspapers all felt like they'd been read before. You couldn't get any information out of them.
Yeah.
So finally, the things get... And all of a sudden, people are swearing at each other, paper and everything. It was absolutely no... bare-knuckle fights in the press, one side against the other, and everybody... She goes, you actually got real stuff in there. She goes, I feel here like this is long before any of this stuff was going on. Bush might have been president, forgetting it.
And, it was there. It's just everybody ignored it because the Republicans were paranoid.
Well, here she goes, I feel the same way. I feel like the press has absolutely been read before. And this is long before. I just think the press has been absolutely denutted by budgets and by... the whole industry, to me, is in disarray. And nobody pays anybody. There's no investigative reporting of any kind. I don't know how much of it's bias or how much of it's just is incompetence.
Yeah, I don't think it's... I know you look at things from an economic perspective. This is not... I don't believe this is an economic issue. I believe this is an ideological issue.
Well, why do we let the... I'm going to go back to the thing about Russia because I have some pretty interesting questions, I think. Why do we let the chairman of the Federal Reserve talk for an hour on TV like some drunken five-year-old, talk about all the different stuff that caused inflation, none of which did, and nobody asked him a question about what really caused it? How does that even happen?
Because it's inconvenient for the administration to have its acolytes out there challenging.
But he did the same thing when Trump was there.
I don't think this is anything new, guys.
Yeah, he did the same thing with Trump there. Hey, before you ask that, Greg,
Trump's.
They've been doing it since Greenspan.
Trump couldn't spit on the sidewalk without being regularly called.
The Fed's been doing this since Greenspan. Greg's absolutely correct. I got a question for you. When you talk about Russia and the time you were doing this, I mean, I don't know why all of a sudden I'm really curious. Maybe the listeners are too. What was the?
Oh, by the way, I was going over there between three and six times a year for extended visits. So I had some familiarity with what was happening.
Well, what was the republics, let's say, you know, pick one of them, Kazakhstan or someplace, what was their government like under the Soviet stuff, and how did the Soviet people control them? There had to be a government of Ukraine or of every one of the different spots. Were they semi-autonomous and just kind of told what to do generally, and when they broke apart, were they pretty much already formed, or how did that work?
It depended on the region. So places where you had a heavy Russian influence, like Ukraine, the Baltics, Belarus, and parts of Kazakhstan, you had a fairly heavy hand with communist officials who party officials who were selected to be put in charge of those regions.
But was there a local like senate, for lack of a better term, and local leader?
There were Communist Party elections. Okay. Yeah, and so they had regional administration that was quote elected unquote. But these were all Communist Party officials selected and managed by the party organization in Moscow. The countries outside of Russia, within the Iron Curtain, the government system varied dramatically. I mean, I was in the former Yugoslavia what a month and a half ago, and listening to the people talk there, I mean, they thought they had it pretty good. Tito was able to insulate much of Yugoslavia from heavy Soviet influence. In fact, I think he told Stalin he wasn't gonna let the KGB run their operation there, and so there was a fair amount of personal freedom, if not really political freedom. Romania, on the other hand, was run by a guy who was a Stalin disciple, and so was East Berlin, or so was East Germany. Now the Russians maintained the Soviets maintained a major thumb on East Germany because they viewed the Germans as existential enemies. It was a little bit better in Poland, but Romania, East Germany, places like that, very heavy Stalin influence. What the Soviets referred to as the near abroad, their former republics, they had their own government system, and generally the Communist Party officials there were allowed to manage their own operation as long as it didn't get too crazy. There were specific Soviet interests, for example, in Kazakhstan that were protected at all costs. Their nuclear test facility there, their rocket launching facilities, those kind of places, very heavy Soviet, traditional Russian Soviet influence. The management of the oil fields in Baku, very heavy Soviet influence. Otherwise, places like Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, they pretty much told the locals, go ahead, do your thing, don't have revolts break out, no open criticism of the Soviet government.
How did the taxation work? Who got what?
Well, they typically paid a value added tax on everything, and. As far as I know, there was no income tax on Soviet citizens.
Well, so the day they broke apart, they just told the Ukraine guys, "Okay, you're on your own," sort of. And then, on the total taxation, how much did Ukraine have to pay to Russia, or how did that work? The guys
it was done. It was done on a case by case basis, depending on the industry.
Okay.
A certain percentage. See, the way it worked is that the Russians would, as I said, the Russian Federation would place value-added taxes on and tariffs on its products that were being purchased by the locals, and in exchange, the Russians bought, production and lots of natural resources from its vassal states at inflated prices, and this was a closed system, so there was no competition from outside, and which is why so much of their consumer stuff was terrible, and virtually all of their stuff was terrible, and why they were engaged in industrial espionage, much like the Chinese engaged in industrial espionage against us from day one. So it was a closed economic system. The revenue that went to the Russian government was in the form of levies on certain businesses in the sales of those businesses, but it was on a case by case basis. It was quite corrupt, from what I understand. All this fell apart when the Soviet state dissolved, and I will tell you, as somebody trying to set up a business over there in the 90s, each locality was enabled to tax to whatever extent it wanted.
Really?
We ended up rewriting a number of oil contracts and oil production contracts. So you want to set up an oil come in and take over an oil refinery in Kazakhstan or begin drilling in Kazakhstan, you would come in with your business operation, and the locality would come in and say, okay, well, I want a 50% tax on anything coming out of the ground. And this was in addition to the 50% tax that was imposed on you by the region, which was in addition to the 50% tax imposed on you by the national government.
Pretty all these 50% is you don't get much at the end.
Well, we literally sat down with Kazakh officials on a couple of occasions and explained to them that there was going to be no investment if in fact you were taxing people at 100% of the whatever gain they made.
And you sort of walk them
away from that. But that was the result of an incredibly corrupt political system, B, a total lack of economics, economic knowledge by the locals, and zero business sense. So
we used to have tax rates that high here. When I went to not the world traveler like you, but I did go to Denmark for a wedding, and I think the guy told me when he sold his auto parts place, Denmark took 70 or 90% of the capital gain or something. It's not like it's unheard of. I mean, it's crazy, but it's not unheard of. What is there? I've heard tell, and I don't know. I've never been able to ask anybody. This is knowledgeable. That the difference between China and Russia is that China's always had, going back centuries and centuries, essentially a market economy that's been buried by various rulers. But
China historically had a very well-developed mercantile class, which is why when you get the Chinese outside of communist China, they tend to run over everybody else in terms of their economic success, Singapore.
Even there, towns have open markets. I mean, it's not regulated on what you produce as much, at least in the farming communities. But I've read that Russia, you can't just say, okay, tomorrow we're not going to be communists, we're going to be, well, I don't even know how you define capitalists anymore, but we have a free market economy. They kind of wouldn't know where to start. Is that true?
So I'll give you my take on this, and this is a fairly high level take. When the Soviet Union collapsed, and you can stop me if you've heard this before, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you had a very well developed capitalist class that was operating in the Soviet Union. It was criminal. There was a thriving black market that operated underneath the Soviet economy that provided something like, 50% or 60% of the fresh fruit and fresh vegetables that were distributed in Soviet markets and arranged for consumer goods and all kinds of things being shipped in from places like East Germany, where they actually knew how to manufacture stuff. But this was all done off the books underneath the official planned Soviet economy. And these people were criminals. And it was acknowledged that this criminal element was functioning, but these guys knew how to read a balance sheet. They understood profit, they understood loss, they understood how to set up for businesses. What they didn't have, they had a forced market because it was a closed system. They didn't have any kind of demographic or advertising or product sale information except within the local scope of their black market enterprise. The guys that had that information when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was an organization that had that kind of information and that kind of reach, and that was the KGB. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed and they just, the government did a terrible job of turning loose lifting the regulatory restrictions on business, you had a natural merger of the criminal class, which knew how to run businesses and understood, voracious, unregulated capitalism, and the police state, the KGB. And the KGB very quickly turned its operations to assisting the business class. And so you get this quasi, I've referred to Russia as a kleptocracy. you get literally a criminal element running the government, and that's what happened, in my impression, in Russia.
But I mean, what I say is there any history of local banking, local borrowing, even if it's from individual people where money comes down? I mean, is there any way somebody could like get capital or anything you sort of need? They have any kind of a free economy? Is it all done through essentially the criminal element or the government?
Any capital that moved, and the short answer to that question is no. They were trying. If you look at the history of Russia, starting in about the late 1880s, going into the early 20th century, you start to see efforts to develop a functioning middle class and a functioning monetary system outside of the monarchy, and you know, the guy I always think of, Pyotr Stolypin, the Russian minister who had the Tsar's ear and was literally a reformist and was in the process of building up this middle class. And the Russian anarchists assassinated him because he was too effective. And that pretty much meant the collapse of any effort by the monarchy to build a middle class kind of capital network. Well, once the Soviets took over, it became and then dissolved. It became impossible in Russia to put together any kind of investment opportunity in the country if you were coming in from outside. The minute you put money together, Tom, somebody rats you out, informs the state, or informs the criminal gang, or just that information is immediately available to people that you don't want it available to, and you get a visit from some fairly thick-necked guys in black leather jackets and black shirts.
What happened? I mean,
nobody in their right mind. When I was doing work there in the early to mid 90s, the one thing we were absolutely certain of is that we would never put money into a Russian bank or Russian financial institution, and that's still the case.
What happened? You're probably the only person that I know of. I could maybe get an answer to this question. I remember reading Arm & Hammer by Arm & Hammer. Have you ever read that?
No, but I know who he was, obviously. But
it's you know him as the head of Oxy, right? Essentially, what everybody knows about Occidental Petroleum.
Occidental Petroleum, sure.
But I'm going to say that part of the book, I don't even worry about reading. I don't know if I read that part. The first two-thirds of it is one of the most amazing period pieces of America and Russia I've ever come across, because the guy had the most amazing life. Just a little bit. He was born in New York in the garment district. His family, I guess they worked in the garment district, and stories about people sleeping on the fire escapes at night because the heat would be so hot at night you couldn't stay in your apartment. The kids got a step and the parents got the platform. And anyway, his dad was I think I've told you this before, his dad was a doctor, and during the Depression, capitalism, whatever our system was, despite all the stories you hear about everybody was true blue to the government and the American way and all that crap, the fact is it wouldn't work very well. And a lot of people there was a huge Naziola, they didn't call him Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden.
No, it was the German-American Bund.
Yeah, well, and his dad went to some communist meeting. He was not a communist, but he went to this meeting, and somehow or another he went to somebody's house to do a birth, and I don't know what happened, but they accused him of doing an abortion, which he didn't do. He's trying to deliver the baby. So he ends up in jail. So Armin Hammer, who had gone to med school, was a doctor, said, I'm not going to just go see my dad every weekend. I'm going to try something else. And he went to Russia, back when you had to buy your own candles to be on the train, the Trans-Siberian Express. And he met a guy in the train regarding asbestos. Or it was either asbestos or something. He ended up being mining asbestos over there, back before anybody knew what was wrong with it. And he became he made all the pencils. Evidently, pencils are hard to make. I mean, you know, it's not easy to get the lead inside the pencil, basically.
Adam Smith was right.
Yeah, well, he ended up making a fortune over there in Russia. And he knew all these guys. A long way to get to my question was, he said Lenin was probably the second smartest man he ever met after Esther Roosevelt. But Lenin, evidently, when he first got in, tried all these austere kind of things you're talking about and realized none of it was working. So, like, within a couple of years, he changed it all around. And Russia immediately began to develop, according to Armin Hammer, incredibly fast, whatever year this was. And that's when he got bumped off.
It was called the New Economic Policy. Lenin was an abject domestic terrorist, and an ideologue. And after the Russian Revolution, which was a brutal thing, and he finished suppression of his enemies by basically starting to murder them.
Well, that works.
He eliminated opposition, and yeah, the Russia fell into a fascinating time in the mid-20s when arts and sciences began to flourish, but their economy was in such a disaster from World War I that they couldn't really move forward. And Lenin saw that he needed to modernize or basically reinstitute capitalism. And that was they couldn't call it capitalism because they were commies, so they referred to it as the New Economic Policy. And the people that they identified who were going to be able to move forward under this were called the Nyepomen, NEP, Novaya Ekonomicheskaya Programa.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah, well, this is a function of my ability to wake up out here. But the NEP men were literally the people that Hammer, who Julius Hammer, who was Armin's father, who was an active communist supporter in the United States, and he became the center for smuggling embargoed goods out of the United States into the Soviet Union through Riga, if I remember right. Anyway, the point is, this new economic policy began to work. And then Lenin died, whether he was poisoned or died of natural causes. But the fight that occurred inside the Kremlin resulted in, Yosef Vissarionovich Stalin taking power. And Stalin was an old line, power mad, psychopath dictator. He focused on his goal was to completely transform the Soviet Union because he believed it was about to be invaded.
Excuse me for interrupting. Did those guys get along or were they enemies, Lenin and Stalin?
Lenin kept Stalin at arm's length, is my recollection, because he was very ambitious and brutal. I think Lenin recognized Stalin's usefulness as a for brutality, but didn't. I don't think looked at him as somebody that was going to give him the intellectual underpinnings that he needed to transform the USSR.
Where did Trotsky fit into all this anywhere?
Well, this is where I'm headed. Okay. So Stalin believed in, Trotsky believed that the goal of the revolution was to go international and to proselytize across Europe, transform the European governments, which were all in a disarray because of the worldwide depression, transform those into communist states. Stalin, and he was a bitter rival of Stalin, and Stalin said, no, we got to do it internally first, and we're about to be invaded and destroyed, and so we have to do it internally. And so the two of them were at odds. Eventually Stalin forced Trotsky out of the country. Trotsky flees and is murdered by the KGB, well, then the NKVD, I believe. So anyway, Stalin eliminates his enemies, and Stalin turns this new economic policy back to a fully regimented state economy.
But it was pretty much working, though, right? I mean, it was starting to.
I mean, they were able to import hundreds, if not thousands, of Western engineers and scientists who came into the USSR to work there because the Great Depression had. Of course, Lenin was gone by the Great Depression time, but people had started to come in to work at a new world, start the new world. And there were thousands of these people who came into the Soviet Union, they almost all disappeared when Stalin took power. They were viewed as totally unreliable because they were Western.
Really?
Although they helped build. Yeah, there's a great book on this, and I think it's called The Forgotten.
A lot of people claim that Stalin killed more people than Hitler.
There's no question that he did. I don't think. I mean, the numbers go all over the place, but I don't think there's any question that, you know, Hitler killed 6 million Jews. The estimates are Stalin's camps and the suppression of the kulaks and the enforced famine in Ukraine and other places probably killed somewhere upwards between 10 and 15 million.
Well, how big a balls did the guy who finally killed him?
Well, we don't know. I mean, he supposedly died of natural causes.
Right?
But
well, everything I read claims that he they put a huge dose of Coumadin in his wine.
Could well be.
It's rat poison. It's tasteless.
By the time he died, he was, you know, getting even more mentally unstable than Joe Biden. And was starting to get paranoid about. I mean, they'd already had a couple of attacks on the Jews and pogroms, and he was getting ready to kick off another pogrom against the Jews in the Soviet Union. But anyway, to go back to your point, the new economic policy began to succeed, but Lenin died, and then when Stalin took over, he went to something called the 5-year plan, which, you know, set up an organization called the Gosudarstvenny Plan, the state plan, Gosplan, that regulated everything down to, you know, shoelaces. I've told you my toilet seat story first visited Russia in 1979 or 1980, where there were no toilet seats on any toilet in the former Soviet Union because the Gosplan had allocated her a certain number of seats to be produced by these two factories, and the plastic for the seats had been preempted by the plastic supply had been preempted by the Ministry of Defense, and so with less plastic, they were using injection molding. With less plastic, they still had to meet these numbers, and so they just used less plastic in the seat, and the end result was you ended up with a wafer thin toilet seat that the minute somebody sat on it started to crack. And after one person sat on it, the next person that sat on it got pinched in a really bad place. So the Russians would just tear the seats off the toilets because they couldn't sit on them.
And, well, you remember they sold a lot of this is from my early economic stuff, the history. They sold a lot of stuff by weight, not by volume. Potato chips. This thing is sold by weight, not by volume. But
it depended on what the state plan called for. So for toilet seats, the state plan called on a certain number of seats to be produced. And they paid incentive payments to the factory managers. So they used capitalism to incentivize their factory managers. If you made your quota of toilet seats, numbers of toilet seats, quality was not an issue. This goes back to something those of us who have been in the military know very well. If ease of measuring something is much more important than the actual outcome in a highly regimented system, and at some point when you can, if you get to a way of trying to measure the quality of your product, that measurement, if it's easy, becomes the actual measure of quality rather than, you know, a surrogate for it. And so for toilet seats, to use the example, the measure of quality was not whether the seat actually functioned as a toilet seat, but actually how many of them you got out of the factory.
My guys who taught me this stuff said they would judge how many nails you made by weight. So they ended up with like a gazillion railroad spikes and not a whole lot of finishing nails.
Yeah.
The Canadian hockey team when they first went over there.
The chandelier bolted to the ceiling.
Yeah, the guy thought that was because the chandeliers were so heavy, he had to bolt them to the neck of the floor above. The guy undid it because he thought that was the bug. The Canadian hockey player, that thing goes crashing down below, and he goes, oops.
Yeah, I mean, I, I, when I first flew on Aeroflot as a crew member in, I think, 1980, whenever it was my first visit to Russia was, I believe 1980. They had a rudimentary inertial navigation system in there. Now, our INS systems at that point were probably the size of a small, very small laptop computer with, you know, small buttons that you punched and you could program the thing, and it was, you know, LEDs and the whole bit. The Russian system that I was dealing with had these gigantic crappy plastic push buttons that literally clunked as you pushed them in to try to insert stuff. And it felt like something that had been made in a high school shop,
really,
shop class. I think it worked, but it just, you know, this was the typical model of their production. And again, it's why they and, you know, China and a number of other places were engaged in such heavy-duty industrial espionage, because without those incentives, and this may be China's genius, you know, in terms of how they've adapted their communist system. The Russians basically, when the Soviet Union fell, the Russians completely deregulated their economy, and that, you know, essentially collapsed the government and led to the imposition now of what you've got in terms of the strongman rule. The Chinese did not deregulate their economy to that extent. They maintained a very tight control on the economy and gradually leased out the, you know, it allowed capitalism to develop, but with very, very tight controls over who was doing what to whom and for how long. And the Russian Communist Party, the Soviet Communist Party, simply was unable to maintain the kind of control that the Chinese did.
Well, but the Chinese were, somehow or another, if you look at China, because we went through this the other day, I was kind of speculating economic theory. Imagine me doing something like that. Because we have, you know, a bunch of people on the show that, you know, this whole thing with Mexico putting the plants down there and trying to do the North American trade was a big fiasco from day one. And I don't know that it was a bad idea from day one. It clearly has not worked out. But I just was wondered, and, you know, you're not, you know, you don't hold yourself out as being an economist, but you're more one than you think you are. I'm not accusing you of that. When you talk about, you know, the people in the factories in China and the people in the, you know, making $3 an hour still in Mexico, it appears, putting pickup trucks together, when it should be, you know, whatever, $20 by now, and they should be accustomed, that didn't really work out the way some people had planned. Is the money just being siphoned off? I mean, I guess in China, I'll use those guys first. Even though I'm paying, you know, the guy in the factory still, you know, I'll say $1 an hour, is my what do they say in Casablanca? There's always ancillary expenses. What did Sidney Greenstreet say? There's always on something expenses. And are my other expenses, you know, to pay the party guy to make sure that they don't strike and all the other stuff, are they? Because there's a lot of rich people in China. Just the people in the factories aren't them. Are my other costs pretty high? I mean, in here, at least here, I mean, you know, you might have to pay somebody $25 an hour, which is fine. They probably deserve it. As a matter of fact, I'm sure they do deserve it or more. But you don't really have to pay the political operative to put your finger, keep your finger on the guy's neck. I mean, do you have any idea how high those charges are in those countries? I mean, to deal with the, you know, the Communist Party guy in Russia or the Communist Party guy in China, it must still be pretty cheap because so many companies are over there. But it's got to be something, isn't it?
Well, the tariff, if you will.
Yeah, that's a good term.
The tariff for doing business in Russia is incredibly high, because it basically eliminates your ability to make a profit, which is why Western businesses are staying the hell away from that place, except to the extent that they can conduct their transactions outside of Russia. China has done a better job at integrating their markets with their communist system, so that the payoffs, the greasing of palms that has to go on to get things done, is less evident and less expensive. But you know, a huge number of the millionaires in China are either Communist Party officials, children or close relatives of Communist Party officials, or friends of Communist Party officials. And so the generally any successful business person in China, for any successful business person in China, you can draw a straight line to the Communist Party. For any successful business operation in Russia, you can draw a straight line to Vladimir Putin or one of his close friends.
Well, the people we had here, people associated with the firm, we had six or seven people from China here on one of these U.S. Department of Agricultural things, and I'm going to say out of the seven, the young lady who was in charge was, let's say, amazingly bright and uncommonly attractive. So I could see how she worked her way up. Not saying she did anything untoward or anything, but the other six, every one of them, it was a, you know, family of doctors, first person, somebody else knew somebody, and some, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, they didn't get on this essentially 2-week trip to the U.S. just because they graduated high school. Okay,
the person in charge was very likely a member of Chinese state security.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, she was 28. You know, but she there was a guy at the CBOE who likes to ask some of the wackiest questions, worse than you and me, Lou. We're at this dinner, and he says to him, "Say, how about that Taiwan?" Just out of the blue, and the girl had it all figured out. She goes, "We sort of view them as the adolescent child that got away for a while and will eventually come home," or something along those lines. She had the party line right at the tip of her tongue.
Oh yeah. Well, if you want to read some really entertaining stuff, go back and look up the Doonesbury cartoons when Nixon was going into China and they send Uncle Duke, that Hunter S. Thompson character, into China as sort of the U.S. ambassador. It's about the funniest thing you've ever seen, but it echoes, I think, very closely the kind of cultural turmoil that China was going through on its way to where it is now. But the Chinese will manage their economy about as well as you could with a nation of, what is it, 1.3 billion people?
Yeah. With all the natural disasters and everything else they've had there, and the fact they can't produce their own food.
They've made a concerted effort to allow Western companies to come in, flood the place with money, flood the place with technology and knowledge, get them spun up to where they can, you know, very effectively compete with us and you know, ultimately surpass us, because that's their express goal. And so that's been managed very carefully, while Russia has been, you know, scattered and unfocused, and you know, as somebody said, Russia's basically a gas station with nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Hey, Kevin says that we both have given good examples of Goodhart's law. That a study or a statistic, as soon as it becomes a target, it's useless as a statistic.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he's exactly right. And as I said, if you any member of the American military, or I assume Western militaries, but any member of the American military knows exactly what that is. One of my favorite stories is, you know, when I was on active duty and cholesterol became a, you know, we were talking about the cholesterol first became a sort of apparent factor in terms of heart disease and people dying early. And okay, so we want everybody to keep their cholesterol under control. And, you know, what we're trying to get at is a fit fighting force. How's that for alliteration?
Yeah.
On Saturday
Well.
The morning. And so suddenly, because measuring physical fitness was problematic, and it required a lot of effort and testing and things like that, but you could measure cholesterol with a blood test. And so the organization of which I was a member began requiring commanders to advise them of the average cholesterol level of certain types of cholesterol within their units. And if your average cholesterol level didn't go down, that was a ding on your effectiveness report.
Really?
Yeah. It's the stupidest thing ever. You know?
God.
But it became a measure. It became a surrogate, as Kevin just adequately, you know, Clayton just noted, it became a surrogate for the thing it was supposed to be measuring. And, of course, it became absolutely useless.
Hey, Lou, we have a Dan's not going to be on today, so we have a guest. We're going to talk all about the health of the agricultural economy, and he's a broker on the Board of Trade, but knows people who work on the Board of Trade really know their industry.
Because, I would think so.
But later we're going to have John and maybe Mike come on, or Kevin, and talk about where all this stuff in the college sports is going, because I went to a Sox game the other night, two nights ago, and talking to some people about it, and the attempts with people, we'll talk about maybe more next week, how to wrap this whole stuff in with Title IX and things like that. And evidently there's now going to be 105 people can be on football scholarships, so supposedly Notre Dame is up the amount of girls' volleyball scholarships from 5 to 18 to be able to keep Title IX going.
Speaking of simplistic ways of measuring compliance, yeah.
Well, my question, there is, I believe, because I've heard from other people, but I've heard from you, I believe, more. Everybody who signs a NCAA scholarship agreement essentially signs the same piece of paper, right? Or has been traditionally?
Yeah, traditionally, yes.
Has there been any move to change that, given what's going on?
I'm not aware of a move to change the basic NC2A contract. Obviously, the NIL agreements are all over the place.
Well, so I guess my question is, if some of the schools, like Miami of Ohio, evidently has been a big recruiter here in the area. Now, they're going to spend a lot of money on people. I've heard of private jet flights and things like that. I'm going to say, Lou, and you can put a better number on me, it's 25 to 40 grand per recruit to get them in your place, just to get them there. Maybe it's 10, maybe it's 20, maybe we're estimating. But these guys aren't flying Southwest Air anymore. They're flying people back and forth on private jets, right? So you've got that cost going in. Now, as a freshman, you're giving somebody 40, 50, 70 grand worth of education, plus all the best and trainers and all the other stuff. So by the time you're a sophomore and maybe you haven't even played for that school, the school's into you, or you're into the school for $2.25, $2.50, and all of a sudden you say, I'm out of here. My economic mind says someplace, somewhere, that is going to be rectified. That the school getting you is going to have to pay, or you're going to have to pay some of that money back or something. But I was wondering, what, suppose, you know, the law firm of Lou Cheatham and Howe decides to sponsor four kids for Duke's sake, because you like Duke. And I got to believe that if you come up with a bunch of money for some kid, you're going to have an agreement that says, I'm paying you 100 grand a year to show up, you know, three Saturdays in the summer to talk for our law firm. And by the way, this is a four-year agreement. And if you leave, you owe us something or something. You're not ditching out on Duke after 3 years when we're into you for 300 grand, and all of a sudden you're a star and you're going somewhere else. I mean, somehow or another, my economic mind says to me, that's going to change, Lou. I mean, do you see that happening, or do you think I'm nuts
well,
as usual?
No, that we talked about this, I think, a year ago, maybe less, with respect to bowl game appearances. You know, you've got NIL money. And now I don't know, I haven't heard of individual contracts, although there was a lawsuit working its way in Florida aimed at a specific booster. But generally it's going to be the NIL corporation that's been established that will have the contract. But I don't see any reason why you wouldn't have a contract that says you owe us a minimum of X number of years. And, by the way, you will if you're a football player, you will participate in any bowl appearances. And if you don't, we pull, you know, X amount of money out of this.
Well, what do you suppose? You're the lawyer. Say, for instance, a simple case. The kid who played quarterback at Notre Dame last year, he'd already been 4 years at Vanderbilt. Was it Vanderbilt or Villanova? One of the two. He already had all those school records, and he's coming back. He gets his COVID year. So, zounds, Under Armour gives him an NIL agreement. And Under Armour just happens to be Notre Dame's school, right?
Sure.
So he goes to Notre Dame. Now, they're not going to just... There has to be some piece of paper or several page piece of paper.
I'm sure.
What do you
I'm
suppose
sure there is.
The contract he signed with Under Armour, what do you think it'll look like? You have any idea?
It would look like a personal services contract.
You know, saying he had to play ball at Notre Dame and he had to show up for practice.
We're paying you for, you know, to wear our product and do some, you know, do some promotional work, and we're gonna pay, you know, X for that, and so it'll look like a typical personal services contract that you would see I probably looked at 20 or 30 of these when I was doing NFL agent work, you know, it'll have provisions in there about appearances that you have to make, or, you know, wearing the product or whatever, but it'll be specific to the extent that it can. To the extent that you try to impose draconian terms, like you can't quit early, or you have to play in X number of games, or you have to be at a bowl game, you know, you run the risk of driving the kid somewhere else.
Well, can it say in there you have to play for Notre Dame and show up for practice every night and make sure your grades are okay?
I would say it would say you have to remain eligible to play this particular sport at this college, yeah.
Really?
I don't see why you wouldn't be able to do that.
So they're going to be there. It just might not be the regular NCAA one. Lou, we got a dash here, buddy. Good stuff. You know, I love that stuff about Russia. Because I mean, it's how other places.
Well, remember, work you're only getting my interpretation. There are lots of other people who look at things.
You're better at this economics than you think. I know you're going to be mad at me for saying that, but there's a big, you know, there's a big unity between economics and politics, right?
Very much so.
All right, buddy, take care of yourself. Have a good weekend. SP Futures up 15, NASDAQ is up 52. Be right back.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Howe. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 13. NASDAQ Futures up 48. Dow Futures are up 265. We got going up to the Dow. Apple's up 341. A big relief last night when NVIDIA didn't... It's down $4, but it didn't... It's pretty much maintained its recent run-up. We also have Salesforce up 1220. They had earnings as well. Over in Asia, we have the... Nikkei down 9, call that flat, 38,362. Hang Seng up 93.5%. Shanghai down 14.5%, 28.23. And Russell talked yesterday about how those, that's happening over there, and how the mainland's becoming kind of a shambles economically. But I don't know if he's exactly correct there, but I think he's probably right. He usually is. DAX up 134.7%, FTSE up 26.3%, CAC around up 56.7%. Now again, this was after a really horrible day yesterday. Dow was down 159, S&P down 33, but the big mover was NASDAQ on 199. That's 1.1%, so that was a big move there. Bonds down 2 basis points, 3.82. The blend down 2 basis points, 2.23. Japan unchanged, 0.89. Oil up 40 cents, but still hanging in the 74.92, mid-70s. It's been buried the last couple of weeks, and quiet. A little bit of a pop when there was supposed to be some issue someplace, and then with the Middle East, then all of a sudden it came right back down again. Brent up 38 cents, 79.03. Natural gas down 2 cents, 207. Back up over two bucks, however. Gold up 16.80, 25.54. Silver up 30 cents again, 29.50 again. Tries to make it over to 30, and it gets smacked back. Every time it got over 30, you sold it and bought it when it got down to 29, you'd had a pretty good year. Then again, you can trade in retrospect real easy. Foreign exchange, dollars 110.90 against the euro. The euro's actually slipped a little bit. British pound 132. So the dollar strengthened a little bit the last day. Japan's 144.58. And we have Bitcoin, which got clobbered yesterday. Back up today, 859. Back up over 60,000. I think it traded 58,000 yesterday or something. So bounced right back up. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, everyone. It is 7:02 here in Chicago. We've got 71 degrees. It is humid with cloudy intervals. Sunshine, high of 79 today. Phoenix, 84, mostly sunny and very warm. High of 108 there.
Ouch.
Traffic.
Ouch.
Inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 17 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 47 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 34 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 22 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 29 minutes. Cubs beat the Pirates. That was a shootout, 14-10. Sox lost, big
they
surprise.
They were down like 9-2 or something.
And then Diamondbacks beat the Mets, and that was 8-5. U.S. Open, Iga moved on. And Alcaraz and Djokovic both moved. The third round starts. Or they start playing, I think, in a couple hours.
Did the Sox lose both games?
The Sox played both yesterday and...
No, they played two games yesterday because I was there the other night when it got rained out.
They lost to the Rangers 4-3, I see. And what was the other one? Maybe it was rained out?
No, they must have played two yesterday. They're supposed to. They only had four pitches the other night.
I got to get back to you on that one.
All right. Well, introduce our guest, will you?
Oh, yeah, we have Mr. Tommy Grisafi. He is owner of Ag Bull Media and has the farm insides for us today, even better than I do. Also, commodities broker we'll let him talk. And here you guys go.
Tommy, how are you?
Doing well, guys. Coming to you live from Nashville, Tennessee. But you guys in Chicago area?
Yeah.
I live in Valparaiso, Indiana, not too far from you, and spent a lot of time at the Board of Trade. Went down there in 1990 on a high school field trip. Never left. Still doing it. Not as well as we used to, though. Things have changed in markets. It's hard for an independent trader to be active and make a profit consistently. Consistent is the key word there. But now we help farmers manage risk using all those things we've always done, using those corn options, bean options, wheat options, cattle options, etc.
So, really? Good for you. My brother, right about the same time, traded in the corn option pit over there. Now he's president of our PTI Securities. And he loved it. You guys probably crossed paths. One thing you said, though, it's a shame to me. Matter of fact, I think it's horrible. It's no longer a career for people, which really sucks. I mean, how many people came down there after high school, were a clerk, were a runner, were something, and all of a sudden became, you know, something higher up the chain, and was a career, and it was a live part of the loop, and it was really a huge part of Chicago's economy that I think a lot of the politicians and other people don't realize how much of a part of it was, and it maybe is a little bit, but not like it was.
Yeah, you know who is a great benefiter of the silliness of Chicago politics and the exchanges going digital was the state of Indiana. I can't tell you how many traders I know have sold their house in the suburbs and move out to Chesterton, Valparaiso, Munster, Indiana, and say, heck with these higher taxes. My kids are already through college. Sign me up for a nice country club by you and, you know, sell your big house in Illinois, buy by something.
Tell me, it's my significant other, and she's still representative of PTI Securities as well. And on the show, she says it's sort of evened up. People have been, I'll use the term fleeing, whatever you want to call it, to Indiana. But when people first started doing that, you know, 10 some years ago, I mean, you could sell someplace here for, you know, $350 and buy the like place over there for $190. That's not happening anymore, is it?
No, not at all. COVID, we did even up. You know what happened? The actual building cost to build something new has skyrocketed so much. So the fact, like, my home in Valparaiso, Indiana, is a nice, modest home. But if it burnt down, I couldn't afford to rebuild it because the cost has doubled. So it's 4,000 square feet, but I only paid $1 a square foot, right?
Yeah.
Now that would cost $250, and I don't see myself living in the $850,000 home when my kids are in college, right? So, yes, it has evened out.
Well, she, the last person that she sold their house here, and they moved, but the guy still commutes to Chicago. And when the tolls went up on the Skyway and the tollway this year, his tolls back and forth and the parking downtown are like more than he's saving on the house.
Yeah, it'd be cheaper to take a helicopter in now. just, you know, New York, they do that. They fly it from this side of the city to that side.
They might. I think you and I probably never quite make it to that. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to do that with Oprah. You ever have a place?
Yeah.
We used to
Oprah
see her.
Had a place in LaPorte, Indiana, and I knew the gal
actually,
who did her landscaping.
It was in Michigan. It was like
Michigan City?
No, you know where, if you right between Michigan City and New Buffalo, if you take a right, okay. There's an area over there in Michigan that a lot of people have these huge, like, ranch sort of mansions thing. There's probably 30, 40 of them. And she was over there. Not Muhammad Ali, some fighter had a place over there or something?
No, he might have been over there. Yeah, there's, you know, Sawyer, Michigan, New Buffalo, Michigan. New Buffalo's the first exit, but then there's some little hidden gems.
Right.
Sawyer, Michigan, yeah. I like it over there. Matter of fact, when I'm in Valparaiso, we always tend to go right, which would be let's go to dinner in New Buffalo instead of going to dinner in Chicago. But the city's changed. I might be moving down to Nashville. I'm kind of digging the Nashville vibe. There's a lot of good people down here doing a lot of media just like this and a lot of talent down here. If you need video editing or vocal talent, obviously there's a few people vocal talent, right? But just a good vibe in Nashville, kind of digging it. Very expensive down here. Don't know what I'll be able to afford except for a nice two-bedroom rental.
Well, Tom, with the we got to pick your brain a little bit about the agricultural world and my background. Well, I've done a bunch of weird stuff, but I've been basically a trader forever, but did a lot of stuff before that, and I went to University of Chicago, learned a lot about economics, and I was fascinated by it, and I really kind of kept up, which, you know, most people don't, I guess, because it's so damn boring, right? And somehow I've locked onto this inflation thing, because that's what I did was I was at Pullman. I was the inflation guy. And the thing that always bothered the hell out of me about inflation is how it's not even. Some people benefit by it, and some people don't. And you can pretty much pick the people every time who are going to benefit and the people who won't. My question, and Greg has been saying some of this, and that's why he wanted to have you on, that the farmers last year, you know, wherever a mean farm is, made something like $225,000, and this year he thought they were going to make like 60. Well, I don't see corn prices up, you know, as much as maybe some of their expenses, but I want you to answer the question. Where in the table of winners and losers in pretty nasty inflation over a five-year period is the average farmer? Is he a winner or a loser?
That's a great question. I can do a good job answering that because I'll give it my best shot. But that's my favorite thing to talk about when I go do public speeches is how inflation just absolutely made the land-owning farmer wealthy beyond belief. Now, full disclosure there, the land-owning farmer, if you're just a son of a son or a son-in-law of a wealthy farmer, you're not wealthy, your father-in-law is. And like my friends say, you can marry more wealth in a day than you could make in a lifetime. But inflation inflates things, and let's talk about things that farmers own. Now, it's changed a little bit because the inflation cooled and the used equipment market's absolutely collapsing. But let's go back a year. 1 year ago, corn prices were better coming off the craziness of 2022 and the Ukraine war. But nonetheless, we all know how we had this inflation. But if we don't, let's just take it 30 seconds back and talk about it. when COVID hit and we took 2 weeks off to just calm things down, that ended up being 2 years. Not only our government, but every government in the world flooded the market with liquidity, aka maybe we're running 12, 14 trillion dollars of negative debt. Well, there's very little negative debt now in the world, and there's actually positive. So for we have this last 13, 14 years where interest rates were extremely low. We tried to raise them in 19 and we did a little bit. But then with COVID, we smacked them down to zero. And in many ways, we kind of created like a quantitative easing that had them at less than zero. That created inflation. And so when you're a farmer and you own land and you own equipment and you own bins and you own stuff, all stuff, almost all stuff massively inflated. Your home, that little home out in the country that wasn't nothing special, doubled in price because the replacement value of everything. And so nobody, almost nobody I know, has benefited more from inflation than the American farmer. Now, if they're listening out there, they might be pissed and think I'm some type of crazy, but I have an office in a
bank. Well, your description of the farm owner,
the landowner.
Yeah.
Right. The guy working for him might be on government subsidies, no doubt, because that's a $20, $22, $24 an hour job, no benefits. That description of the person working for the farmer is a person in America who has three jobs and is struggling. But the land-owning farmer, if I sent you a chart right now of land prices, you'd be like, wow. I do an interview every month with a guy, and he'd be great to have on your show. He's called the Land Talker, and he does an evaluation. He tracks all the land sales in the state of Iowa.
Wow.
And a huge percentage, and I'll get you his information. Jim Rothermick, the Land Talker, great little newsletter. It's free, and guy's awesome. You look at historical prices of where land was 15 years ago and where it is now, we'll say easily it tripled. And a lot of people back then owned their land. So you have someone who's worth $4 million, all of a sudden worth $12 million. And their biggest problem,
Tommy,
is,
those assets, I'm not a tax accountant.
I know where you're going with this. Loss?
Well, no, I'm saying if you're one of these guys and the farm going up a whole bunch and your basis is $1 an acre, mm-hmm. and you croak, well, we're all going to croak one of these days. If you croak, now when that goes to your kids, is that like stock where their basis now becomes today's market value?
It changes, and I'm not an expert on it. I know this. There's a pretty high threshold right now, so you're allowed to inherit X amount of money without being taxed real big, but above it seems like above $8 million you'll get taxed a bunch, but you're like, oh, that's too bad for those people. But I know farmers who are worth $100 million.
No, what I'm talking about is on a specific piece of asset. In other words, if you're not as much on the security side as I am. Well, obviously I own a brokerage firm, so but if you bought IBM at $10 and it's trading 200 and you get run over by a bus today and the IBM directly goes to your heir, the basis for the error is now 200. He never has to pay taxes on the 190. And I'm wondering if a farm is the same kind of asset. I think it probably is, but I don't know.
I wanna give you another name of a guy who does this all day. He's called the Ag CPA. That's all he does is answer questions like this. His name's Paul Niefer. And whenever I have a question like this, I'm like, Paul, help me out with this. I got a farmer. I know they complain about it a lot. I know farmers talk about I would say older wealthy farmers' biggest problem is that they're so wealthy and they have no idea on how to manage the wealth. That sounds weird, but I know so many miserable millionaires who are so disgusted that if they die, they're going to owe millions and millions in taxes, and they're constantly trying to find ways to not have to pay those taxes.
My biggest client when we started the firm and a good friend left the country to not pay taxes.
But
I wanted to give you one for when you give a speech. Mm-hmm. You start talking about inflation. I'll lob one at you. Feel free to use it. When you've heard, I assume, of the Weimar Republic.
Refresh me.
It was the German group after World War One.
Okay.
And inflated the hell out of. We had to bring a wheelbarrow of money to buy a loaf of bread. I mean, they were the poster child for inflation. In their economy, the people that absolutely were for it were the farmers, because all of a sudden the price of their product went up so much, they were able to pay their mortgage off in like 2 months.
Okay, I'm writing this down. Now, I will tell you this. Now this makes sense, because I was sitting in my office at the bank at North Dakota, and I had a farmer come in. I said, boy, are you worried about inflation? He said, I'm literally going to inflate my way out of debt.
Yeah.
And I said, I was confused. I was like, let me get the pen and paper out. What are you talking about here? He goes, well, listen, the price of grains are inflating, and my costs are inflating. It costs more for seed. It costs more for chemical. He said, but I owe the bank right now $2 million. But when I redo my balance sheet, land prices have exploded so much. My net worth went up $4 million this year. And so I inflated my way out of debt. He said, I could sell one tiny chunk of land, pay off my bank note, and be one of the wealthiest men, not one of the wealthiest men in the county, but extremely liquid, which when you talk about farmers, you think about the 80s crisis, and you think about how there was a problem with liquidity. And when everyone talks about farmers, they're like, oh, this inflation's just like the 80s. It's nothing like the 80s. In the 80s, a farmer was borrowing 100 grand at 20%. My small farmers borrow $1 million at 9%. And so the whole thing with farming right now is you could either be paying 8-9% on an operating note, or you can go to any bank in America and plop it in an old-fashioned account and make 5%. So 8 and 5. You're either paying 8 or making 5. And as you know, I think that's a difference of 13. That is how you see the winners and the losers in the ag economy.
All right, two questions. And if hopefully we'll have you back on, because my style of interviewing, I don't have any questions that I prepare. I just listen to you, and the questions come as you.
I love it. I love it. Shoot away.
And two questions. If when we have a government, this is not a left or right issue. We have a government that is bound and determined to let Amazon and Microsoft borrow money at 2.5% like they were. Why the hell is a farmer paying 9? If the Federal Reserve actually gave a shit about moving the prices down for every person in this country, they obviously didn't force them down, did they?
Right. And so the basics of banking is, they're always just trying to make that 3%. And the every bank in the world could have went to the Fed window a few years ago and got money almost for free. And they were giving out to farmers at 4 and 5%.
Oh, they were getting it at 4 and 5. Three. Okay.
Yeah, so they used to it's just whatever a bank can have on a CD rate, they're always 3 higher. So there was a whole year where a CD made 0.25, 1/4 of 1%. And if a CD is making 0.25, which is nothing, grandma got nothing, and the stock market was going up 25%, the farmer was borrowing money at 3.25.
Right, so they when did get down there, okay.
Oh, forever, right. Yeah. That was the lost decade of free money. And there's not a farmer out in the world, if they can go back in a time machine, like you do in the movie Back to the Future, who was it, Biff or Duff? He got the book, the winning book, right? And there's not a farmer in the world, if you knew what was going to happen, what would you have done? Every one of them says, I would have bought 3 times as much land, massively borrowed money, and dealt with it.
Well, when you can borrow money under the rate of inflation, the world is your oyster.
Yes. And that's changed. And I like to see interest rates. I spent a lot of time in the bond pits in Chicago, so I've traded a lot of corn in the corn pit, but I spent a lot of time in the 10-year notes. And from what I can help farmers with interest rates and math of that, it's actually from all my years of trading the knob spread notes against bonds. And I'm sure a lot of those people in the bond pits and stuff. So I traded both in the corn pit and the bond pits. And it's really helped my career, because the finance of ag is a fun subject. And
I played softball forever with Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder?
Yeah. Remember
That's
him?
That's awesome. What pit was he in?
He was a... Was he Treasuries? I think he was a bonds guy. He was a bond guy. Big guy.
Have to look. Yeah. I was down in the bonds from 93 to 2000. Then I went and left trade electronically in Evanston with a proprietary group. Remember when TT started all electronic trading platforms? I went up to Evanston and started trading with a group up there. So I was quick to leave the floor in the sense that I thought it was drying up.
I'll tell you we've talked a bit about, the ownership piece of farming. What if you and I just, we were oblivious to that, which a lot of people are. I sure was. At the CBOE, I was leasing 10 seats rather than buying 2. Talk about being a dumbo. The if you and I had been leasing a farm and paying all this stuff, and because a lot of people, if you're a smaller farmer, you lease other people's property, right? I mean, that happens all over the place.
All the time.
So how is that guy doing? I mean, in terms of lease price versus seed price versus fertilizer price versus end product, is he making dough or no? Or is he
no, guys absolutely losing money?
Really?
100%. Unless a grandma, uncle, someone leased you the land affordably and let you use the equipment, we call them the cash rent cowboy. The cash rent cowboy is absolutely getting decimated when it comes to what's happening in the mathematics of farming. So going back to the front part of the conversation, if you own land, you just went through one of the greatest wealth creation cycles ever in history. If you don't own land, you're a year or two away from going broke. Just no one sent you the email. As you know, in the pits, they never send you an email before you go broke. It just kind of happens. And with how low the corn price is and how high the inputs are, for example, fertilizer prices have actually went up from last year's levels, and the price of corn is $1.25 lower. And so the mathematics are not looking good in 2025. So as a commodity broker, it's made my world extremely busy. Everyone's having a heart attack, rushing into the doctor's office saying, help me get in shape. And I'm like, you already just had the heart attack, right? We're trying to stop you from dying. I can't get you looking like you're in high school football again.
Well, I guess the question is, economics is, but in theory, is not supposed to work that way. If the price of corn is down, is there a lag time where next year the price of fertilizer might be down, or more people are going to plant soybeans, so there won't be as much demand for it?
Great question, yeah. Well, the fertilizer, how fertilizer is, the people who control fertilizer in the world is pretty much a mob. The price of fertilizer is controlled by a few people.
And that's right where I was going. Is that a concentrated industry? Suspect that? But I wanted you to say yes, because you know more about it than me.
Yeah, so you hear who has a lot of fertilizer? Russia,
yeah,
Canada, and then the people who own these mines where you get these fertilizers. I know this, you cannot grow corn without fertilizer. Corn's just like your front lawn. If you don't put anything on it, it's going to look horrible. You hit it three times a year with the little sprinkles, it's going to look great. And it's going to be green and lush and produce a big ear. And fertilizer runs the world when it comes to corn, and fertilizer prices are high. And that's what's scaring the heck out of my clients, is the high price of fertilizer, the high price of labor, you know, inflation's coming down, but no one's asking to make less.
The inflation rate is coming down. The prices aren't coming down.
Exactly. Ring the bell. Ring the bell. That you couldn't have said it better, my friend.
Well, what does this, I've read stuff, and again, I'd love to have you on. I read stuff about somebody had a big, I don't know who sent it to me, it might have been Greg, about they're trying to get people who plant corn to plant, I don't know, is it beans or something, for the 6 weeks before they plant the corn, because if you turn the beans over into the ground after you harvest them, that it actually is accretive to the soil and you don't have to use as much fertilizer, plus you get a bean crop. Is all that kind of research going on to use less fertilizer?
Yeah. But you still need fertilizer. So that the best way to explain it to your viewers and listeners is a soybean kind of poops a little bit of fertilizer. So when you plant soybeans, you don't put you put some chemicals and stuff down, but not the fertilizer. Soybeans actually leave a little bit of fertilizer in the ground. And so what you're talking about is the natural rotation. That's been going on since the beginning of time. A farmer might plant in the old days in the prairies. He'd plant wheat. He'd plant flax. Then he'd leave the ground still for 1 year. And then he would start it over. Now with modern chemicals and sprays and everything, we can have a drone go spray a problem spot in the field. But you do need fertilizer. So fertilizer is like a couple of really important things to add. Water, which hopefully Mother Nature makes it come out of the sky. And two, fertilizer. And then high quality ground. So we're trying to maximize, farm the best, ditch the rest, farm the best ground, give it everything you got to grow the bushels. One thing I always say at Advanced Trading is, we're in the bushel business. You're not going to be able to be in farming and save your way back to prosperity. You're not going to be able to save 200 bushels an acre and have a record yield. It doesn't work like that. Like any business, you got to throw some money out there. You don't want to throw stupid money out there. You don't want to go to the farm show. Every guy in a tent's got some new product that he's going to tell you is going to be McJack and the beanstalk type of grain. But you got to be smart about it. And farmers are the most innovative, creative, resourceful people I know.
What this is not a shot at anybody who's running for office, but when Trump did the tariffs with China, it seemed to have affected the soybean growers and corn growers in the upper end of the region, because they're the group that sends their stuff basically by rail to Seattle and to China, correct, or the Far East?
Yep. PNW. Yep. So the fastest way to get a soybean from America to China is to load up a train in North Dakota, ship it on the BNSF, Uncle Warren's Railroad, and get that to the PNW, and then get that on a boat and get it to China. You can whole process a couple weeks. Leave North Dakota, take a train, fly into a boat, and sail across the sea, call it 3 weeks round turn. And when we did that fighting with China, it decimated the price of soybeans.
Well, they have no way of getting from Minnesota. Well, there's always a way. You could put it on a truck, I suppose. There's no real way to get it from there to the Illinois River to New Orleans. I mean, there is a way, but it's going to cost you a bunch.
So that would cost dollars and dollars. So sure, if soybeans were $6 in North Dakota and $9 in Illinois, people would start trucking them on the weekend, right?
Well, you could train them down here too. They have trains from Minnesota to Chicago.
Yeah. We'll. Right, that would be turning the trains around. Like, there's a natural flow of grain, and the Mississippi River is so important in that. So just look at the Mississippi River. If you're east of the Mississippi River, you tend to stay east of it. If you're west of it, you tend to stay west of it. And both people tend to flow down it. And you're asking grain to flow from the upper Midwest to the center of the Midwest, which your best growing states are Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana. We don't need any extra soybeans because we're awesome at growing them. So the North Dakota farmer really took it in the keister there. What's happened since then, though, is we've started opening these crushing plants. And so big, big, big money, the oil companies, everyone else said, they have a poor basis. Basis being the difference between the cash price and the futures price. We should build the plants where the cash market's always weaker. And that's helped out the Northern Plains tremendously, yes. But I do feel... both candidates, no one's really a giant winner for ag. I don't feel like my ag clients are like, you have to vote for so-and-so because of this. Like, they're like, ah, we're in trouble.
Well,
neither of these candidates care about ag.
Well, we've stayed away from politics. Good. I'm going to make a prediction that in the next 62 days before the election, neither one of them are going to talk about any issue that I care about.
I like it.
And probably like none that you care about. Hey, we have to have you back, because one last question. I got to wrap it up, but my producer Greg is the creep every year. You know, I guess you could, maybe some of it was a little bit's climate change, but some of it's also some of the seeds. It doesn't take quite as long. Are we still creeping north every year in terms of how north you can grow soybeans and corn, or is that sort of stopped?
No, absolutely. Great question. Great way to end the show. Technology's changed so much that when I talk about the I-States, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, it's not really true. We grow some monster bean yields in Cass County and Trail County, North Dakota. We grow good beans in Canada. The genetics, these companies that do this, BASF, Monsanto, Bayer, Dow, DuPont, they spend billions on getting these seeds to be like, get in the, like they're military operations. These little seeds are like Marines. Their job is to plop them off, get in, get out, and do their job. We're only getting better. AI, well, this will be another day, another episode. I know we got a break, but AI is going to affect agriculture a lot next 5 years. Thanks for having me on.
I lied. One more.
I love it.
One of the guys who does some stuff here for the firm, well, used to, he goes out and he picks sweet corn for the Chicago Food Depository, right? And they get a big group. Everybody's got a SUV or a pickup, and they pick all day, and they head over to the food depository. It's a really nice thing they do. He goes, it's the weirdest thing on earth when you're walking down, because sweet corn evidently has to be picked by hand. You know more about that than me, but he goes, you walk down there, and with all the different the genetics, the bugs are all over you, and they're not on the corn. He goes, you wonder, what the hell is in this corn that the bugs don't even want?
it's a freaky
thought when you're out there.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, no, they're working miracles everywhere. That is funny. Yeah.
Well, take care of yourself.
Thank you.
We'll put you out on the. We're gonna tweet out that you were here and so forth. And Love to have you back. God, good stuff. I mean, I learned between you and Lou today. Today's my best day in a while. SP Futures up 24, and NASDAQ Futures up 94. We'll be right back. Talk about college scholarships. Ouch.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds?
Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Welcome up, Base Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 23, NASDAQ Futures up 89. Hey, that's one of the best interviews. That guy's terrific. How come you waited so long to get him in? Instead of saying thank you for getting him in, I'll say, how come you waited so long?
It's in demand.
You know what? What a terrific dude. Well, he knows his stuff, eh?
Yeah. He was, when he was on the floor, you know, always willing to share, too.
Really, I mean, it just seems like, you know, you just get a feel for somebody right away, and I'm like, wow, talk about impressed. We'll have to have him. I wonder, he likes...
They've got a great YouTube channel.
Really?
I'll put it on there.
He's going to go from Indiana to Nashville. Well, you know, our buddy Roy has kind of moved back to Nashville.
And right.
Because his mom, and he likes it down there. Well, he grew up there. I mean, he likes it there. Do we have Mr. Flanagan?
Johnny, you do indeed, Tom. Good morning.
Do we have Mr. Murphy or no? We never found him. Dan, what'd you make all that?
Now you're going to have to settle.
Going to have to settle for Kevin? Well, that's okay. Hey, I kind of led into it a little bit. What'd you think of that stuff about the agriculture stuff? Boy, I had a sort of piece in there about the Weimar Republic because they were the farmers were the biggest lovers of inflation.
Right.
And it's,
well, it's a great interview. I really enjoyed listening to him. Thanks for having me.
What'd you make? Lou says that the I led into it from the kind of the legal part. Of course, we have our own legal guy here with Mr. Flanagan, but led into, we talk about a jump. Are because of the NIL stuff, has the basic scholarship agreement changed? And I guess it hasn't. Lou says it hasn't. He doesn't even know if anybody's trying to, but. Sure seems like there's a lot of stuff that's a lot of what money people are getting. Every time somebody gets money, there's got a contract with it of some kind, huh?
Well, the coaches are trying to dial as much back as they can because it's so inconvenient for them to manage rosters. So, you know, they have all kinds of proposals out there, but I don't know if any of them are going to fly.
Well, last week, just as an example, I mean, of course, I should remember the names of the teams, but Georgia Tech was playing FSU in the big game, and then Georgia Tech had the big upset, right? The game after that was it Florida somebody and somebody against, you know, some lesser level team, right? And I think the Florida something and something team had 28 transfers. Now, does every one of them have some kind of a deal? Does every one of them, is this smaller school have enough people? I know, Kevin, you said before, and I'm sure accurately, that these are people that they may have recruited in the first place and already had, you know, films and so forth on them. But I don't know if it's all 28. I mean, how many people does a school of that size have to have? It has to be 28 out of 80 that wanted to get there, or 50 or 60. Who the hell has the time to look at the films? How do you even get the films? does everybody have an agreement? Does everybody have one of these places they put his name out to a backer and everybody's there's an offer and a lot of rejections? I mean, does the kid, the normal one of the 28 kids, have five offers of money from five different places and he has an accountant go through them? I mean, I have no concept of how this is even happening. Do either one of you?
I don't, but I would imagine it's some kind of agent clearinghouse relationship where you've got, people being marketed to, to places to see which gives you the best offer in the end. And then, somebody gets a piece of that as a commission of some kind. It's got to be something like that, I would imagine, just because of the complexity of marketing yourself. I just don't see that as being, tenable or profitable for somebody, a college student or a would-be college student. But somebody else could certainly streamline the process and know the ins and outs of it and handle multiple people just as you would in the entertainment industry and negotiate contracts and everything else. So I got to believe that there's something far more sophisticated and, well-managed than can be done individually. I have no personal knowledge of any of that, Kevin, so I'm just speculating and found too, but it would seem to me that that's how it would have to operate to make money for everybody.
Well, I only have a little knowledge of it, and because I don't actually talk to people who are involved in it. I do know someone who has a son who's a football player who transferred. But a lot depends on the level where you are. So, yeah, I am sure that the market for a Riley Leonard, who will start at quarterback for Notre Dame this year, or, those kinds of things get kind of interesting in terms of, who is brokering the deals, how's that work. Whereas when you're looking at players for Florida International or something like that, which sounds more like an airport than a college, when you're looking at players for there, they may say, we can come up, we have some people who can come up with $10,000 for you, and that's what we have. And you're not going to see more. It's not like you're chasing and squeezing the last dollar out of anybody. You're not going to see a lot out of any of them. Yeah. So it just depends. It's like every other supply and demand market. The best products are going to get the biggest price. What's weird about it is that the schools are supposed to have no relationship with these collectives that have sprung up.
Well, that's crazy.
Which, of course, defies any kind of believability. I still think they are de facto employees of the college, and sooner or later that's going to come and bite the colleges in the butt.
Well, I'm always curious about, and Kevin, you did this to me. I was always curious about detail, but you made it worse talking to you 2 days a week. As a former board member of a very small spot, I can't imagine what the presentation would be to me or you or Jen in the Florida International boardroom where somebody comes up and says, our football team has never made a dime, and we got, or maybe they made a little bit, I don't know, and we got this new thing now where we got to review 100 guys a year or something along those lines, so I need like 10 guys to man the portal, and by the way, here's our budget for that. And I'm sitting there going, you said what? I mean, at some level, I got to wonder what the guy's even talking about. I mean, that's what kind of, so talk me out of that naive thought that I have, because they're all doing it. I mean, it seems to be.
Well, I can't imagine the scope of the football portal. I know the basketball portal is big, but I also know that in the days when I was covering Notre Dame basketball, that was just done by the coaching staff. They'd get up in the morning, they'd pull up the portal, and say who are the new entrants in it today, and if there was anybody that they wanted to go recruit, they'd go recruit them. I think once you get a lot of the big schools have had recruiting coordinators and some assistants, office assistant types who've done this kind of stuff before. I would imagine that is ramped up because now recruiting, everything that has been done in the process of recruiting high school players, which was a multi-year relationship that you would establish with these kids is now out there for transfer players, and only it's a shortened cycle. So yeah, you're going to have a bunch of people hired to be on top of it. You know, some schools are going to be like you said, they're going to have 28 transfers come in, they're going to, you know, remake the whole team. There are probably more schools who are out there saying we're going to take six or seven every year, and that's what they really need. And so I think it's probably not as big a staffing deal as you think at the major universities, because they already have a fair amount of talent on their rosters.
But somebody's going to have to come up with, or have some kind of idea of the number, because the first conversation is going to be, what are you paying? And the assistant coach, he can't be in the dark on that. I mean, like they say they are. I mean, it's got to be insane.
Yeah, the recruiting process has got to be, you know, here, you know, I'll set you up with the coaches' meetings, and then I'll also set you up with a visit for our NIL people. And because they have no contact whatsoever, a coach would never give any kind of guidance that would suggest the amount to be paid to that player.
Oh, yeah,
that
right.
Could never happen. That could never happen.
Well, when I mentioned earlier,
I personally, I'd hire John to do the job.
Well, yeah, but now, but John, when are we going to see that? You know, young Joe Flanagan wants to transfer from you know, Northern Illinois to Notre Dame because all of a sudden he grew and he's really pretty good, and all of a sudden he gets in the portal and somebody says, Joe, you're not in the portal. You signed a 4-year deal with Joe's Pizza in wherever the hell in DeKalb, Illinois. I mean, you're not going anywhere. I've been paying you $10,000 a month, and that's to play football here, not for Notre Dame. You better give me my money back, or you're not out of here. We're going to see that pretty quick, I think, aren't we?
Oh yeah.
Go ahead, John.
And Joe knows people who will break your legs if you leave.
Yeah, I'm saying are we? That has to be. I have to believe that. I mean, I use the example of the kid at Notre Dame who got the Under Armour contract, NIL thing, just as he was going to Notre Dame, who's an Under Armour school, that somewhere in there is you got to play quarterback for Notre Dame. You know, I mean, how would that even be worded, Jen? I mean,
yeah, I mean, just as Lou was saying, you know, it's an employment service contract. What does this do for the economics of having a sports team at all? I mean, you talked about this a lot, Tom, about at what point does it not make any sense to be, you know, in effect wagering or betting on the drawing power of any individual athlete or a bunch of them if you've got that scholarship money being thrown around. But at what point does this become unsupportable and there isn't enough interest or ticket sales to make this worthwhile for a college?
Well, it's at some point, I mean, there is a point. I think there's always a point. Doesn't seem like we're there yet. I mean,
yeah, I know, but I have a feeling that, you know, you'll see a huge shakeout in, you know, 5 or 10 years of programs that fold or scale back or whatever. And I just don't see how there's enough attractiveness in, you know, the limited amount of TV coverage you can get, I think, today, and just the, you know, appeal across the board. Especially with Title IX being involved, I just don't see how this becomes not even a moneymaker, but just something you can break it even on.
Well, I think somehow, and this is kind of above our pay grade, but I'd love to be able to do it, Kevin. I think somehow you have to trace the money. You can only pay out as much as you're taking in. I mean, you look at the Notre Dame phenomenon. It appears that not only are there people, their graduates, loyal, but appears that they seem to do pretty well. I mean, the amount of money I saw at my 50th reunion and the fact that there's even more skyboxes on the stadium doesn't appear that we've reached in. What's the Morris Inn? The hotel that we didn't even want to stay in because it was a dump is now what, $600 a night?
You know, hotel nobody can check into, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, and it's, I mean, we're, some places it appears that schools are very happy because now they're making millions of dollars, and by the way, a bunch of, well, I'm going to say at Notre Dame, they're looking for indulgences or something. Somebody else is looking for some part of their body to grow an inch or something. What possesses a, you know, a guy at Alabama or Texas A&M or something to you know, to pay a gazillion dollars to football players so they win a couple more games. I mean, I've never been in that group, but obviously it's a big group. If you can get some, imagine it at PTI, if I could get a bunch of Jim Oaks to pay all the salaries of 10 good producers, how well PTI would look. Really?
Wait a minute. You would have retired 10 years ago.
Wait a minute. You're going to produce $1 million worth of business for me and some other guy's going to pay you because he likes PTI? Well, wow. How do I sign up for that deal? But you guys are asking, is there an end to it? And my guess is there's maybe not an end to it for 40 or 50 schools or maybe 60, but there's a very soon end to it for the rest of them. I mean, what do you think? On that level. That's my guess, but again, that's like saying what the market's going to up or down today. And what do you think, Kevin?
I think if you start looking just at the economics, let's zero in on a collective for a minute, because a collective is just, you know, it's a payroll basically for the football team. Now, you probably have a few players who are involved in there who really have the chops to be worth it as promoters for products, and then a bunch of other people that are along for the ride. You know, but seriously, how many people out of college during their college days have had a significant advertising impact in the last couple of years?
Well, there's a couple of model ladies and a few guys, and I'm going to say there's 30.
Yeah, at tops.
Yeah,
tops. You know, and you'll get some real high earners like a Caitlin Clark or a Caleb Williams did really well. There's your people. And they're, you know, whatever anybody wants to pay them to own to have the ability to market their name, image, likeness, they're probably making money. The rest of them can't possibly. Now, a lot of them, you know, there's a lot of things where I don't pay much attention, where there's people doing social media marketing and, you know, they pop up in a lot of different places and they may come close to breaking even. And certainly, you know, they're as good as any other model that, what's his name, the tight end for Notre Dame, who I can't remember, he got drafted by Oakland. He was doing stuff for Levi Strauss social media marketing. I'm sure he made a fine Blue Jeans model for all of their ads, just as well as much as any other model would have. So good for him. That's fine. That's probably a break even. But you know, your average fatso, big bellied offensive lineman, what are they selling?
Well, it might be on somebody's podcast doing some. I heard the other night that either the number one returner for NIL stuff, either the number one or number two. I would never have guessed. You know who that is? Or was last year?
Go ahead.
What's his name? The guy who pitched for Pittsburgh yesterday. His girlfriend.
Oh, Skeens.
His girlfriend.
Oh, his girlfriend, yeah. The gymnast.
Livy Dunn.
Yeah, and she's, I guess, some incredible model. She makes a fortune. It doesn't surprise me. But, But I guess I wouldn't have guessed that. I would have guessed Caleb Williams. There's probably somebody. But I guess my point is that you look at the economics of all this, and this is what's fun about it for me. I mean, one of my bands, I think you might have met him, Tim. He played ball for Bo Schembechler, Michigan, of course. He's got some scratch. So Michigan's always on him for this collective. Now, let's say they talk him into sending him $200,000 or some number. I mean, whatever the number is, doesn't matter. Now, this collective is going to have 25 people on a basketball or a football team, maybe a few on a basketball team, and they're going to schedule Kevin and John's son for marketing. They're going to go to the pizza. They're going to be scheduled in when they're going to pay your son's $50,000 a year. Okay, well, that's fine. But somewhere along the line, they got to be getting 60 or 70 from you, because they can't go back to my buddy and say, we need another $100,000 next year. I mean, the things, at least once they get started, they somehow have to be self-sustaining, at least, if not a profit center.
Right? Well, if they're going to hit me up for $100,000, I want some return on my investment.
Well, that too.
It has to be a profit center. Yeah, it doesn't... The NIL doesn't work as a donation model. The schools, the setup under the schools and the program sort of did work as a donation model, but they're so different as they to try and keep them segregated and keep this arm's length relationship at most. It doesn't work and it doesn't make any sense.
Well, one group is trying to do the. The donation, Jan, you and I talked about it, where they, if you donate to them, they pay the person $500 an hour, 3 hours a week, or 4 hours a week to go talk to kids in hospitals. So they're saying that's a not-for-profit, so your donation every year is the least tax deductible. Now, I think so far, from what I read, the IRS is not coming after them and saying that's BS. So as of now, they're getting away with the contribution, the tax deductible contribution model, if it's set up that way. Now, then, you think that lasts forever or no, John?
I think it'll morph into some sponsorship relationship where it will certainly be for profit, and there'll be enough of a difference in what's being contributed versus what's coming in at the other side to make this subject of scrutiny. But that's going to have to be tried out and tested to see where that happens. At what point this thing, terms like nonprofit really matter anymore in any of this? So,
I guess if you're going to give, they're going to try and hit you up for $100,000 a year. You'd like it much better if it was at least tax deductible, right?
Right. Well, you get $200, instead of you look at bigger contributions if you could keep the tax, exempt status. But I just don't. Part of it, there's this nagging feeling that we're maxing out. It's kind of like with sports gambling, generally, and the casino oversell. All this stuff is starting to weigh heavily, in my view, of how much appetite there really is for the kind of projections you're seeing for where the sport, college sports generally, will be in 20, 30 years. And I'm just wondering if there's if the whole thing is some kind of bubble atmosphere, where it's unsustainable and there isn't enough new energy coming into it to make this a kind of long-term bet. So I don't know. I'm kind of a doomsayer about this and have been for some time. And you're right; it hasn't played out that way. There's still enough attraction to keep this engine going. But I look at everything else around it, and I just don't see it keeping up.
Well, the inflation stuff, as we just talked about with Tommy Grisafi, I think that's how I pronounce it. He was talking about how in the farmers area, how some people are richer than they've ever been, and other people can't make a dime. They're working three jobs.
Yep.
But I don't know if you listened to. I was driving home last night, and I listened to News Radio 78, and the guy came on and talking about the. When you look at these numbers, I mean, they're shocking. The BMW, this is the big playoff for the golfers, with the points and stuff, and then they get down to the last one, and there's the best golfer of the whole year allegedly is crowned. The difference between first place money, $25 million, and second place money, $12.5 million, is three times the amount that Palmer and Nicklaus made in their entire career combined. And if you look at, I think Jack Nicklaus won his last Masters he won was 1980, guys. If it wasn't, it was right
that
there.
That sounds right.
Guess what the prize was?
$50,000?
These guys are good, Greg. 55. This year, what do you think the prize
was? $55,000? Well, that was big money.
Yeah, this year, what do you think the prize was?
Oh, $50 million?
$3.6 million. And if you put 1980 into the CPI calculator, it should be up four times, and it's up, how many times is it up? What's 50 goes, whatever, that's how many, it's 25 times? 30 times? Let me get my calculator here. But it's not even, the sports hasn't even come close to inflation for the rest of the people in the world. I mean, it's absolutely off the chart, and it is gambling. Now the latest thing is Florida International is going to be big time, because even though nobody gives a crap about them, I'm not saying that's probably a fine university. The fact is, you and I are going to bet on them. Now, is that, Kevin, Is gambling the savior of this world? It's been how many times in our lifetime? First it was off-track betting, then it was a lotto, then it was, you know, casinos, and now it's gambling on sports. It's always the savior. Is it going to be this time?
For a little while. Look, how long have we talked about what a flawed business model what this was? It's kind of built on this lie of amateurism anyway. So can it go on forever? It can go on for a while. The thing is the tide of the colleges seems to be a big emotional commitment for the fans. So that sells better than, you know, typical minor league sports would sell. So they have that working for them. They also, what they have working for them is a lot of sunk cost. You know, there's a lot of money sunk into the programs such as they are. Stadiums with suites, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, just in infrastructure alone. And that spent money is driving the business model, and it's going to give way very grudgingly. So, you know, I think, you know, even if there's alternatives out there for ways to do this that are a little above board and that make economic sense, it's still going to be very, very difficult for them to get implemented.
Well, you just wonder when people keep, you know, pushing the envelope, which clearly we are. I mean, if we're talking about this kind of tax deductibility, I mean, again, we all went to Notre Dame. To a certain extent, we have an affinity for the place, although it sure as hell doesn't look like my place anymore. We're going a long way from the tax deductibility of Sacred Heart Church and having tax deductibility or paying people to be on the football team and not charging Indiana, not charging event tax for $100 a ticket in the stadium. I mean, we got governments that are broke, and yet we have these enterprises that I don't think the separation of church and state extends itself to the football team and a professional sports sponsored team. I don't know if the three of us are running the president, I'm not so sure I'd want to lob that one out there during the campaign. Well, but I'll tell you what, to me, yeah, that's nuts.
But try changing that law in Ohio, and so that Ohio State can't get the deductibility anymore.
Well, I mean, Ohio State's
with that.
Yeah, well, Ohio State's
good luck with that.
Well, Ohio State is a state-run organization, pretty much, right? I mean, you know, it's a
but in Indiana, if you said I want to treat Indiana football differently, I think most people would say I don't care.
Yeah, well,
just don't mess with basketball.
Well, speaking of which, if you could name some schools, I mean, we talked about earlier, and we don't know the total answer of how big of an operation this is becoming, just recruiting people. I mean, basically, it's becoming like the Bears, right? I mean, or more so. How many schools do you think don't have? When I say this money wise, because I went to the University of Chicago. They said screw it on football how many years ago? Place is still doing fine, right? I mean, I think they're doing more than fine. I mean, I talked to, you know, some guys in the library, but I mean the bar. You got a UCLA had to go to the Big Ten because they get $20 million more a year in TV rights. And I go, do you have any idea how big UCLA is? It's 11 points. Wisconsin and Illinois have total budgets of $7.8 billion. I mean, talk about the tail wagging the dog. I mean,
the flip side of that, though, Tom, is look at the seismic changes in enrollment patterns. So if you've got a place like Western Illinois University, which was, you know, for years a well-regarded place, it's enrollment that was collapsed pretty much from 20 years ago. I don't think any kind of sports program going or any kind of money-making sports program scheme is going to save an institution like that that can't attract students, period. If you're Notre Dame that has to turn a lot of people away and other places too, you'll keep going whether you have a sports program probably or not. But the flip side is a lot of these other places are just not sustainable as institutions, leaving sports off the table. And sports isn't going to be a panacea for them. So I just wonder if there's going to be there will be a shakeout in the number of institutions around in higher ed, and how many of them care about sports anymore, or have long since given up on it, is yet to be seen.
Well, hopefully we will keep our listeners informed the whole way, because right now we're just trying to get all the questions out there. There's a lot of them, aren't there? Go ahead.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, guys, thank you.
And there's a lot of non-public information that really should be more public.
Well,
right, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, guys, thank you. We'll have Dan Janinas back next week. Greg, great show today. Great guest. I don't know when I've had as good a time as I have today. SP Futures up 14, NASDAQ Futures up 53. Thank you, guys. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.